You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the show. Stu Goldsmith here. Today I'm talking to the brilliant Jessie Cave. Is she a comedian? Is she a performance artist? She's certainly an actress. She's certainly an artist. And you can find out everything she does at jessiedoodles.com. You can also go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders to find out more about the effect that her role in Harry Potter many years ago had on her following and how it is a bit like being a member of the royal family in ways that are sometimes good, sometimes less so. All of that's in the insider stuff. We're going to talk about living life with an attitude of abundance. We'll talk about her relentless documentation of her life as a means of seeking permanence. We'll also cover the tragic death of her brother a couple of years ago and how she processed it and the effect it had on her creativity and on her new novel Sunset, which is available now. A content warning as well. Later on in the show, there will be some discussion of sexual assault and the effect that had on her work, on her upbringing. And I will give you another content warning when that is just about to come up. Okay, that said, this is a wonderful episode with a deeply, deeply creative and talented person. This is Jessie Cave. Hello and welcome to the Comedian's Comedian podcast. I am so excited to talk to specifically you because I think you live in creative abundance in a way that I'm really excited by. Do you think that's the case? Have you heard that expression? Are you familiar with the idea of living in abundance? I've never read any books on it. It's a thing I've heard people talk about.
No, but I like it. I like that, creative abundance. It's funny because me and Alfie have a joke about my diet that I live by, which is the abundance diet. because when I was a hormonal stress teenager and everybody was very thin and I was very jealous of them, I would... Gillian McKeith was just coming up and she had the abundance diet, which was basically you can eat whatever you can eat as much as you want of anything. And so I took that a bit far. She meant with, you know, like celery, you can eat an abundance of celery. anyway, sorry. No, but I do think I give off the impression of being, you know, very quirky and creative the entire time. But I think I'm actually a very practical person in lots of ways. So I don't mind if people think of me as a terribly creative person, but I actually don't know if that's true.
The reason I suspect that you're a terribly creative person are the shows of yours that I've seen. I've seen I Loved Her and I've seen Sunrise, and we'll start proper with Sunrise in a minute. But those shows are both completely suffused with creativity and... not just the creativity of writing them and performing them, but they also have things that you've built and things that are embroidered and things that are made and things that are doodled and things that are painted. And it's a real profusion of stuff. And I think that mirrors how you they are. Your shows are incredibly specifically you in a way that maybe surprisingly makes them really relatable, given how incredibly specific they are to you.
That's so nice. I think it's rooted from I've never fit in at all in any aspects of school or as a person, really. And even with career things and knowing what I wanted to do, and I had absolutely no idea. All I knew was that I liked making stuff, and I'm not even particularly good at any one thing, but I am good at finding a way of expressing how I feel. And so the shows and the entire reason I even got into doing shows was, and I really only lately have had the confidence to call it comedy, is because there was no place for me in a career. So it was making things and doing cardboard cutouts of my face or a baby's face or Alfie's face, or even before I met Alfie, I was doing kind of like weird puppet stuff. And it's so funny because when I was reviewed and, you know, they would say I was doing puppeteering, I would feel so embarrassed because it's like, it's literally a cereal box that I've done a doodle on and I don't know anything about puppeteering. But I've just used it as a way of saying some dialogue with somebody and making it a bit easier and for an audience to understand what I'm doing. And I don't know. I've just tried to find a way, basically, of expressing myself.
And talk to me about the difference between expressing yourself and fitting in. Or not fitting in, because that's like a huge thing that you said very lightly. Like, I've never fit in anywhere, and it's very kind of emblematic of you and your work on stage, which is you're incredibly pragmatic about your own emotions in a way that's really thrilling to me as someone who feels, certainly by contrast, you know, certainly by comparison, massively inhibited about the things I'll admit on stage, whereas you are completely uninhibited and sort of ruthlessly pragmatic about relaying your observations about how you felt and how you behaved. So I suppose I've asked two questions at once accidentally there because I'm all excited, but I suppose what I'm asking is the difference between not fitting in and expressing yourself, and just where they come in your character. Do you know what I mean? Because like, one might think that if you express yourself that would lead to fitting in, or is that completely the opposite of fitting in?
I guess it does, and I guess it has to a certain extent made me feel much more, the fact that people have enjoyed my shows and have said that they related to them has made me feel a sense of safety and happiness, but it still hasn't solved the problem of I've always felt like a very socially inept and very much an outsider. But the reason I don't know, it's so funny because looking back at the things I said on stage and written, I am staggered that I've done that. And even now, given that it's been a few years since I've written anything as, I've just written a book, which is fiction, but it's very much rooted in truth. But I am shocked that I was that open. And I think maybe it's age, maybe getting a bit older and having kids that are older now. I am not regretting being that open and exposing us and exposing how I felt as a mother or, you know, a psycho girlfriend or whatever. I'm really glad that I did, because I'm a different person now. So it's kind of like reading somebody else. And that's quite nice because I now have a record of what I was like at that age and that period of time. And I think that's the only reason I've ever done any work creatively, is so I can document that I was here. And I'm a chronic diary keeper. Like, I write in a diary every day, most days. And it's not like I'm writing, "Dear Diary, today I felt like this." It's literally just a record of something my son said or something that I did or my mum did. Or it's and I've had that absolute need to do that since I was about 9. So I think it's just an extension of keeping a diary, really, doing shows.
Yeah, right. That's a really interesting perspective. That completely makes sense. That completely chimes with the way your shows work. Talk to me just a bit more about keeping a diary in order to record that. What did you say? To record that you were here? Yeah.
Yeah. It's mainly a need to appreciate life, and especially when things aren't going great, days can blur into a mess and you just don't realize that you've lived a week and you haven't really recorded anything, you don't remember anything. And I think I'm so wary of not appreciating how great life can be, that I feel like if I don't, like, for instance, I think it's gotten way more worse, and the pressure to keep the diary has become so much stronger now that I have kids, because, I mean, you'll know that, you know, time goes so fast and they develop so quickly, and you then forget what they were like as a baby or a toddler. And,
yeah.
And then you realize that 3 years have gone by and you got photos and even videos, but even the videos you're like, but I don't remember that. And so I think it's a way of me kind of, she said this weird thing today and writing it down and making me aware that I was so lucky to have that moment. And not to get too heavy too quickly, but my brother died 2 years ago. And weirdly, that new year, so it was, he died in March 2019. And that new year, so 2018, 2019, New Year's Day, Alfie and I got one of those really cheesy one line a day books you can get in like Cards Galore or Paper Chase, and you're meant to write down one line every day, and they're like 15 quid each, and I got all my family one and be like, you know, we have to record our lives because we're so lucky and we're so, you know, and so I would start by writing one thing, and I tried to make Alfie do it, but he didn't. He lasted like 2 days. Didn't even last that, actually. But I kept going. And when it came to the day that he died, I remember I couldn't write anything other than, obviously, Ben died. But it was crucial that the next day I wrote in it, because I had, you know, a 2-year-old and a 3-year-old at the time. And I remember thinking, okay, this is going to ruin my life. This is ruined. This is as my life as I know it has ended now, my family's life. So what am I going to do with this? Am I going to let it ruin us? Or am I going to still see that there can be joy in things? And so writing something that Donnie did that day, or, you know, he was dressed in a Spider-Man outfit that day or something, just made me, absolutely saved me. And in the same way with writing Sunrise, which was about when me and Alfie were broken up, and when we were having these terrible conversations about who he'd slept with and all of this stuff, writing it down saved me, because I was like, it's actually quite funny, you know, what he's saying. And seeing it on paper made me feel better. And I think that's what I've just always used writing as a form of therapy.
I'm so sorry to hear about the death of your brother. I didn't know about that.
No. Yeah, terrible. Absolutely terrible. There's just nothing anyone can say, really. It's just absolutely terrible. But that has made me more of a chronic writer.
Do you feel like the expression of your this desire to record stuff, does it? It's definitely expressive. It's definitely artistic. Does it feel healthy when you say it, when you describe it as chronic? Does it feel like a healthy expression, or does it feel kind of compulsive?
It's kind of, I don't drink, I don't really drink, I don't smoke, I don't do any drugs, anything like that. It does feel like an addiction to me, writing, the diary thing. And it's not like eloquent prose here, it's like the most basic record. And once I've done it, I feel like a release, I do. And we've been moving recently, and all of our stuff is in chaos, and I haven't had time, haven't even found my diary, kind of thing. And I've just felt so uptight and stressed, and I know I've missed stuff. And also being, you know, maybe a little bit depressed sometimes. And I have more recently, like, let days slide and just not recorded anything. And it does make me more unhappy. So it's crucial that I do it. I know, and it's just if it is an addiction, I'm going to be addicted forever, because it's definitely, it's just absolutely saved me.
Is there, when you described earlier on, I know exactly what you mean about watching videos of your children or seeing photos of your children. And I think, like, it's beautiful. I'm so glad they exist. My wife is very, the photos, not, I'm very glad the children exist, obviously. My wife is really kind of, she'll take pictures all through the day and then compose them for Instagram things. And as a result, it's like I take pictures. They're all just on a hard drive. And, you know, to go through them just becomes increasingly impossible and frightening. So I benefit, we benefit as a family enormously from having that record that she's kept and organized. But I find myself sometimes it's almost alienating to look at the pictures because you can't climb inside the picture. Like, that happened. But like you say, you see a video of your kid, you go, I remember when they spoke like that. But I don't, you don't get to, it's like your dreams. You don't get to actually go inside them. You just kind of get flickers and what have you. Does that, is there a similar problem with looking back at stuff that you've written? Or does the fact of you having written it make it more permanent or more meaningful than a photo?
I think, I don't know, I have a massive anxiety about photos. I have on my phone right now, I have something like 100,000 photos, and Alfie always tells me to stop taking photos, and I buy extra storage on my iPhone so I can, you know, have as many, I don't ever have to go through them and delete them. Whereas I do feel writing has made things more permanent, and they're forever. You're never going to go through 100,000 photos, but you can read you know, a 90-page thing or a, you know, I do think it's got something. And also, yeah, I completely relate to the not being able to climb in the photo and hold the baby, or it's heartbreaking, actually. And I do really get jealous of people who aren't attached and aren't nostalgic about photos and just let it be and live in the moment. But then I also think if I hadn't have taken those photos, I don't remember anything anyway. So yeah, at least I have a photo. So that's my argument.
that thing of I don't remember anything anyway. Do you feel that you remember less than most people?
I don't think so. I'm just so hyper aware of dying. And I think that comes, it was before Ben, but it's now just, you know, a different level. Because it was just a, you know, a sudden trauma, overnight, dead, done, gone. And that trauma, I think, will stay with me forever and has made me absolutely aware that it can be done in a second. And so every day I live like it is my last day, which is just fucking exhausting. but, you know, at least I'm here and I'm appreciating it.
And do you mean when you say you live every day as if it's your last day, is that a sort of trying to bite down on the day and get as much as you can out of it?
Kind of. It's more I look at the kids and my life as it stands, and I'm very, you know, grateful the entire time. But being grateful is also really exhausting. I'm really, really grateful, really, really tired. I just constantly think I'm very lucky. And I think that's, I'm reading the book that everyone tells you to read when somebody dies, but I've been reluctant to read it until now because I thought, well, I'm going to read the more obscure ones, actually. but I am finally reading The Year of Magical Thinking by Joan Didion, and she's got some just amazing, amazing lines in it that have made me realize that I'm going through something which is just so normal. It's not like my form of grief is like weird and abnormal. It's just everything she's saying I'm feeling. And she has this great line saying that she finds a letter that her husband wrote to her before he died, and at the time she didn't appreciate it. It was just a dedication or something in one of his books, and she said, at the time I didn't appreciate it. And that kind of sends shivers up my spine, the thought that I'm not appreciating the good that's still there. And I think when something terrible happens, you do suddenly realize that your life is that you did have is now over. You're into a different part of your life. And I think that's a huge step forward for me when I think of it, right, okay, that's part one and this is part two. And so it's more that I look at Donnie or I look at Margot in the day or the baby and I'm like, this is amazing, that this is great, they're here, that we're here and we've got to appreciate it now. But yeah, I don't know if that's a symptom and I don't know if that will go on forever. I don't know if I'm always going to be this kind of, you know, desperately grateful the entire time.
Gratitude is exhausting. To be grateful is exhausting. That's something, yeah, God.
I just really resent, or I get very jealous of parents that are really, you know, they don't, they're like, oh, they can go to the nanny the entire time. They can just, oh, great, we can go away for a week. And, oh, I don't have to see them. Oh, they're at school camp. Or parents that just are so confident that their kid is going to stay around. And I'm so to be so deep, but it's just, it's, they're such an amazing thing to have, and we're so lucky, and I just constantly think of how lucky I am in that regard. And I think that maybe because we had a one-night stand and I got pregnant, it was just such a weird miracle. Mm. So it's not like we planned anything. And so maybe that's partly my need to be like, hey, I got a free ride here. I just got in accidentally to this world. Maybe that's it.
I remember I did a gig in Glastonbury once where I was heckled by someone who was aggrieved that I was being too diffident or too negative about my children. I think I just had the one at the time, and I was doing material about, you know, resenting them. And, you know, not just sleeplessness, but, you know, all of those things. Like one of those big breaks where you go, wow, that was part one and this is part two and I haven't acclimatized to it yet. And also I was being a comic about it and being a male comic about it and making it all about me and what have you. And he heckled me and it became quite disruptive and eventually was asked to leave. But he wasn't totally wrong. When he could, you know, he was sort of shouting, they're a blessing. Children are a blessing. And I was like, oh, I mean, you are right. It doesn't, it's not useful for me to talk about all the good things about them because I'm a comedian. And if I just exactly. stand there for half an hour and tell you how wonderful and how life changing it's been, that's not
no,
funny.
I completely agree. There's no, that you're allowed, you're on stage trying to be funny. That's absolutely fine. I do that too. And Alfie definitely does it. and I think that's absolutely fine. And also this is a, we're talking and I'm just being, you know, very sincere about it, but I wouldn't write a caption on Instagram saying, I am so lucky to have my children and I am incredibly, you know, I would never do that. And I did see a lot of that during the pandemic of did you see all the memes of parents homeschooling and stuff? And then there would be people underneath commenting like, you don't know how lucky you are to have children. You shouldn't be joking about, you know, how annoying it is to homeschool. You're yeah. lucky. I was saying, yeah, but it's also really difficult sometimes. And it's also not great all the time. And you have to make massive sacrifices. And we're allowed to complain about it too. So, yeah.
You talked earlier on about your entry into, like, or the fact that you'd only recently started considering the shows to be comedy or yourself to be a comedian. And
I think that's Alfie though. whenever it's called stand up, he gets very, very
right.
like, okay, let's just stop right there. It's not stand up. And to be fair, I do agree with him, but I like kind of joking sometimes that I'm a stand up.
For the listener who is not aware, the Alfie we're talking about is comedian Alfie Brown, friend of the show, friend of mine, common law husband of yours, according to him.
He I don't says know if that's... that all the time. yeah. really... I don't think he should be allowed to say that, given that he's not proposing. It's like, don't say yeah. common law yeah. husband. Just say boyfriend. If you're not going to fucking propose, you can't call me a con. I'm not. I haven't agreed to that.
The reason that, like, ordinarily, if I'm interviewing someone and their partner is a comic, I try to be classy and not bring it up. But his life and your relationship is an enormous part of your work because your work is, you know, you mentioned puppeteering in inverted commas earlier on. One of the things you're puppeteering is his face or his likeness embroidered onto a pillow. And I believe the show I Loved Her, you know, that embroidery behind you with all the different names on it is the names of women he's slept with. I remember being in the audience in Sunrise in Edinburgh in 2019 and you going, just give me a cheer if you slept with Alfie or if you give me a cheer if you love Alfie. I can't remember. I think it might have been if you love Alfie because I nearly cheered.
No, has anyone fucked Alfie Brown? Has anyone here fucked Alfie Brown?
So, it like, obviously, he is a presence in your work, in the work of yours, in a lot of the work of yours that I've seen. I flicked onto yours and BB's podcast on YouTube. We can't talk about that right now. And maybe it was me automatically selecting one in which he was a guest. But there he was again, you know, and like you're kind of, you're intertwined. Your art is often intertwined with him. And so it's interesting. Like I don't know how to kind of deal with it interviewer wise because I just would never bring it up normally, but I'm like, yeah. Oh yeah, that's like quite a huge deal, right?
Yeah, and also I'm not that cool, you know. I think it's very cool when people don't ever talk about their other half, or they, you know, they don't feel the need to write everything they've said down. But I'm not that kind of person.
So it annoys him that you call it stand-up comedy, and so you do to annoy him, which I think is lovely.
Yes. I mean, also, to be honest, it's not stand-up comedy at all. It's the opposite. It's performance art, which is funny, hopefully. And he is right.
Well, I don't know if he is. I mean, it's not stand-up comedy in a narrow definition of stand-up comedy. I think it's stand-up, and I think I'll fight him. I think it's stand-up, and I think it is also performance art that's funny. But I'm interested in the ways in which, like, are those terms useful to you? Is it useful to you to think of it as performance art that's funny? Because it isn't the sort of stand-up that I have ever seen doing 20 minutes on a mixed bill in a club. But you could do that if you wanted to, because the stuff is incredibly dense, really rich, really full of punchlines, and performed brilliantly. So it could sit there. You may not want it to. But
maybe.
What are the terms performance art that's funny? Is that useful to you as a way of thinking about it? Is there something creatively freeing in that? Or what is it that you see that stand-up is that you are not?
I think I was determined when I wrote Sunrise that I was going to do stand-up because I wanted to threaten Alfie and be, you know, similarly on the same scene as him. And when I told him, actually, I'm going to write some hardcore stand-up. I'm going to write some really, like, really real stand-up. And you're going to see me at the clubs, and you're going to be, I'm going to be on before you, and I'm just going to. And obviously, it did not work out that way. I immediately wrote a puppet thing, and it became verbatim chats we've had about, you know, peanut butter toast and stuff. But I think it has helped me get in the door. Having labels like stand-up has got me. I think you need to be called something in order to get on things. And my first show, which was called Bookworm, which I did in 2012, I had never been to Edinburgh Festival before. I had done Harry Potter, but I hadn't got any work after Harry Potter. I was 24 and had no idea what I was doing other than doing silly YouTube videos. And I thought, oh, I'll just go and I'll write a show and we'll go to, that, where do people do shows? Okay, Edinburgh Festival, we'll do that. So my whole family, Bibi was in the show. She was 13 or 14. And I just wrote a funny-ish show about a book club spoof. But I didn't realise that was allowed. I just, because, and the bonus of being in Harry Potter was that they thought I would sell tickets.
Yeah.
So they gave me a room at the Underbelly and I sold no tickets. I had to go out and do flyering and I had to, you know, because that's not how it works. Just because you've been in a film doesn't mean you're automatically going to sell out things. People are so stupid. Anyway, so it's just helped me get in the door by terming it as comedy or stand-up. But I think people are always slightly surprised. And when I have done mixed bill shows and I've come on with my puppets, it has been stone cold silence. So okay. I don't know if I would fit into those things.
So this is Jesse. I'm enjoying this enormously, and I'm just going to remind you very quickly of two things. The content warning for the chat coming up, which is going to cover sexual assault, and also to go to the Insiders Club, comedianscomedian.com/insiders, for 15 minutes of extras about her membership of the Harry Potter franchise and the legacy of fandom and everything that means to her. Also, how the Cave Sisters Patreon has changed her relationship with elements of her following. And if you're not already watching We Can't Talk About This right now on YouTube or listening to it at your various podcast providers, then get on that now and you can join the Patreon, patreon.com/cavesisters, to get the sort of intimate stuff that we are talking about in that section of the Insiders Club. So let's get back to the interview. This is Jesse.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
This is a thing I think that lots of comics will relate to. I decided to do A, but then it just turned into what I always do. So you were like, I'm going to write some stand-up. Talk to me a little bit about that, because what is that, like, you have an artistic intention, you intend to do a particular thing, and then it turns into the thing that is inescapably you, which is verbatim conversations, documentation of texts, and all of that kind of stuff.
Puppets.
And puppets.
Yeah. Well, I think that the desire was to go onto a stage and not have any baggage. I mean actual stuff. I don't mean like emotional baggage. I just thought it'd be so freeing just to turn up somewhere and go on and just need a microphone and then just be able to speak and then come off stage. That must be so easy. You don't have to traipse around with suitcases and worry about something not being ironed or the backdrop not being even, or I thought that's a good, healthy step forward for me in my career, just not to have so much stuff, especially with the hilarious thing about my first show, Bookworm, is that it was a huge set that me, my mum and Bibi did. It was just every show was just an absolute nightmare. But looking back, it was beautiful. And I do definitely have a brain for the fact that I document everything, and anything that's moderately funny I write down. And so I thought, okay, well, this would be useful for stand-up because it's just like observational stuff that, you know, my kids said. That's a huge, you know, market out there. And so I thought, oh, I can easily just do this, you know, how annoying it is to buy kids' shoes. I could do some stand-up about that, or I could do some stand-up about, you know, going on a date and, you know, not knowing if you're going to have a table or if you're going to stand up. I can do some stand-up about that. But it just... it's just not in my nature to be simple about things and to be, you know, understated. So it just turned into, well, I'll do actual dialogue with Alfie, and how can I have Alfie be here? Or I'll just have him as a puppet. And then my mum's idea was to embroider him. At first he was a paper mache balloon. And actually the way that started was when we were broken up, and when, it was really difficult, and I was dating, and I had this 10-minute slot at, I think, a knock to bag gig or something, and I used it as a deadline for myself, as like, I'm gonna be confident and go and rock on and do some stand up on this date. But obviously 5 days before, I had this panic attack and I started paper mache and balloons. But it did, and that evolved into doing, and that was like a first date scene, which was in Sunrise, and then that evolved into doing the whole show. So it was just slowly my confidence built up into being like, okay, this is what I do, so I have to just get on board with it.
You mentioned your mum, and in the episode of We Can't Talk About That Right Now.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you come from a sort of creative, colourful, eccentric family. Tell me a bit about that. Tell me a bit about about what that means, and whether you think that upbringing is part of why you felt you didn't fit in anywhere, or whether what the relationship is between those things.
Well, I'm one of five, and I'm the second oldest, and Bibi's 10 years younger, and she's the youngest. And I begged my mum for a sister, so I have three brothers and sister, and I begged her. We grew up in a very small house with five kids. Even though my dad's a doctor, my mum was a doctor, but she stopped after the third child and became full-time mum. But she's always been creative. She shouldn't have been a doctor. She should definitely have been now what she is doing, which is a seamstress and a creative maker who's kind of my partner in business and everything we do. Like, she runs my doodle shop. We make stuff together. She does all the backdrops for our shows. We sell her backdrops now, you know. So she's doing finally what she should have been doing. But back then, you know, you were either a doctor or a lawyer or a nurse, you know, very straightforward things. And my dad, even though he's a GP, but he's quite a creative doctor. He is, you know, a really good public speaker and is very innovative and is kind of a bit of an inventor. And I think that's what my mum is too. She's very inventive with things. Being tidy or being was just never a priority. The house was chaos. And my mum would just every day add another shelf. So we just kind of collected everything, and the walls were just covered in drawings, and it was just never that was something that she just encouraged and didn't stop. And I think now that I'm living in as a parent and I have my own space, and weirdly, actually, in lockdown, we decided we moved from a very small flat, and then we suddenly had this kind of like breakdown, and we're like, we need more space. And when I was pregnant, so we moved into a bigger house, and then now we've just moved into a smaller flat again. And it's weird. I immediately feel at home living in a smaller space. Okay. I like my stuff being around me. I like there's mess, and I like, well, I don't like mess, but I like all of our stuff everywhere.
Hello, Stu here. We'll get back to the interview in just a second. This is just a quick content warning regarding the content of sexual assault. Jessie is about to mention that she was sexually assaulted as a teenager, and we talk about some issues around that. So over the next 5 minutes or so, we'll be talking about those things. And this is also an opportunity for me to apologise, really, to Jessie and to you, the listener. Listening back to this, I'm not thrilled with my response. I think it was in keeping with the tone of the interview, but ultimately her abrupt kind of revelation made me uncomfortable and I didn't really know how to respond. Listening back to it, I should have at the very least said something like, I'm so sorry, that's awful. And I didn't, because I felt uncomfortable, and that's my thing to deal with, not anyone else's. So with that said, let's get back to the interview.
I think that we weren't encouraged to, we were definitely encouraged academically, but I didn't really do very well academically. And then I also think the priority was working hard. So it doesn't really matter what you do as long as you have a strong work ethic and you work hard. And I think that's just something which I have followed on. And I think that's largely due to the fact that we were very, very competitive tennis players as teenagers. Me and my older brother, Robbie, and county swimmers. The younger three weren't those things. And I think my mum had relaxed by the time that they were that age. But me and Robbie were like, you know, we were going to be professional tennis players, but I didn't grow. I got raped by my tennis coach, which wasn't ideal. And it just wasn't what we were going to do. But so I think sport as a child makes you a very driven, kind of disciplined adult, I think.
As a side note, probably not for the recording, if it's not too much emotional labour, when you drop that in, what do you think is an appropriate response for me so that I can grow as a person?
I know, but I shouldn't say, apparently I should say trigger warning, but I'm like, I'm sorry, I was the one who's raped. Why do I have to give a trigger warning now?
For sure. Yeah.
I've been told off so many times about that.
I don't think you do, but I think I, as a broadcaster, need to put a trigger warning on.
Maybe then in the intro you say, yeah, trigger warnings, there is talk about rape.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also I do talk about it, you know, heavily in Sunrise, so it's not like it's
sure.
the first time I've ever mentioned it.
No.
But we made a massive mistake, because when we started our podcast, the first episode, we were just chatting about stuff, and then we were talking about our sexual development or something, and then I said, well, obviously mine was, you know, annoying because I was a virgin and I got raped. And we started talking about that, and it obviously got picked up by the Daily Mail. It was a nightmare because it was such a lesson in, oh, people might listen to this and they might like take it really seriously, and we didn't do a trigger warning. I'm a bit bad like that.
Yeah, I mean, that is you. I think this is an observation, I suppose, rather than a question, but I mentioned kind of pragmatism earlier on and being matter of fact about your experiences. And one of my observations really about your work is that you are a person of the internet in a way that I'm kind of too old to be. Like, you embrace, you know, the concept of broadcasting your experience on multiple platforms. You know, you're on Instagram frequently, you're a big following on Instagram, and you sort of exist with a sort of relationship with your followers and your Patreon followers for the podcast, and you know, making doodles for people and stuff. You sort of exist in step with the internet in a way that people of my age are maybe I'm too late for that. Do you know what I mean?
No, well, I don't think it's too late for that, but it's in my nature. And also, given that I've never fit in, given that I've never had any ease with my career, it's always been me, you know, banging down doors and finding a place for myself, making my own work, and then eventually getting attention for it. And then eventually, you know, I was in TV development for 8 years. I realized that was just pointless. And now I, you know, I've decided whatever I do in my career going forward, it's going to be I'm going to do it myself. And so the internet is absolutely necessary for those. If I'm going to make things myself, I need to get people to watch it, or I need to get people to buy it, or I need to get people to know that I'm doing this. So it's a brilliant time for people who do want to do it themselves, because you don't need anybody. Mm. You know, as much as, you know, my agent is brilliant, and it's the only kind of traditional thing I have, is, you know, route to tradition is having an agent still. But, you know, I am really keen to do things myself, and I think that's slightly annoying as an agent maybe sometimes, but she's amazing, and she understands that I just kind of get on with things, and so yeah, the internet is just really, really great for me.
And I think there is something that feels to me that feels quite contemporary in your ownership of the fact that you were raped, and the fact that you would say, why have I got to worry about it? Why should I trigger warning it? That feels like an incredibly healthy response.
Yeah, and it's so terrifying to say, because it's like, especially right now, everyone's so careful. You know, everyone thinks we have to be wrapped up, and we're not. Yes, we were a victim, but we are. I'm not living as a victim. I haven't lived my life like that. And I do have a terribly practical side to me, which is like, again, like when Ben died, the next day I wrote in my diary. It's the same thing with this. It was exactly how it formed me. It completely formed me, being raped at 15, because I had to wake up the next morning and decide, oh, this could ruin my life. This could absolutely mess me up now. What am I going to do about it? And I put it in a box, and I decided I'm going to leave that box there for a bit, and I'm going to keep going. And yes, that's not probably healthy. And I have been told probably about 500 times that I should have extensive therapy, but my therapy is working, and expressing myself and talking about it and being funny about it. That's my therapy. That's how I've got better. And it's very disconcerting for people when I do talk about it, because I am quite funny about it. And that's a privilege I have, because it wasn't a brutal rape. It wasn't like it was a stranger off the street. It was actually, you know, incredibly sinister. But at the same time, I can find the funny in it, because it's my thing and I'm allowed to do that. But yeah, it's just, it's really funny watching people's response, because they're like, what am I meant to say about it? But, and even on our first date, Alfie and I, our one night stand, which turned into more, I think I was just straight away came off the bat and was like, I was raped when I was a teen, and I think I was just nervous, and it was just a way of like breaking the ice about it or something. I think I told him about an STD that I had, and just within 5 minutes I was just overspilling with everything about me, so he could make a quick judgment.
And is there an element of that whereby you knew it would be disconcerting for him, and so it changes the dynamic in the conversation?
Maybe. And also, he has a very annoying ability to be quite disarming with, he's very still. And so I arrived flustered and immediately felt like, why is he being so calm and confident and still? And so I just kind of overcompensated by telling him about my vagina or my rape or, you know, all the things I've got in TV development, they're never going to get made, all of the ideas, all of the episode ideas, and just, you know, ridiculous level of information you received.
I'm interested in the marrying in your personality of the kind of sort of effusive, creative, doodling, building, embroidering kind of part of you, and the bit of you that is like a life coach. The bit of you that is like Goggins or someone going, work harder, do more, run faster. And how those things sit together. Do you think that they're necessary for each other to exist?
Well, I thought about this the other day, because we've been moving and I haven't had time to sit at my desk in such a long time. And I'm so heavily, like, at the moment promoting... Well, basically, I've split myself into so many different jobs now because I'd like doing all of them, that I realised I can't do that. I have to be quite clear right now with the one thing I'm doing, because if I want one thing to do particularly well, I can't be promoting my doodle shop, or I can't be promoting my podcast particularly, or I can't be, if I want my book to, people to know that I've written a book and I'm really proud of it and I want it to be read. So I've had to, like, delegate at the moment. And think, okay, it's not the time to do some drawings. It's not the time to do something for the fun of it and creative thing of it. It's time for me to be like business-like about how I'm going to get people to read my book. So I like that side of it. I like being quite business-minded. But I did also realize the other day that I'm never going to be one of these people that sits down and does a painting for the fun of it or just draws for fun. I've never done that. It's always been with an aim to, right, how can I make this a job? How can I do this and people might like it enough to subscribe to me or whatever. It's just always been that way. And I think that's rooted from art school in particular. When I was at art school, I only drawed the way I draw now. And you were told, you know, to do all these different styles and try out different things and different, you know, to see what you're going to be like. And I remember just thinking, what's the logic in that? This is my style. Why am I going to change that?
Yeah.
And they were like, but, you know, you should try, let's try some oil paint today or, you know, print, let's try doing some acrylic or whatever. And I was just like, no, because I like drawing like this. So, and it's my thing. And I actually really am glad that I did drop out. And because I thought, well, no, because I'm not going to be the best oil painter. I'm never going to be able to paint a horse. So I might as well just stick to what I'm good at and move on. And years later now, that is, it's funny because all of my art school contemporaries are really successful artists now. And I see how they did do the variation and things. But they've come back to their original style that they did at art school in the first term. So I'm like, yeah, they can probably draw those things, but their innate style is still them. So it was just, I don't know, there's no point to what I'm saying. But
No. I get it completely. It's about resisting being adaptable.
Mm. I was like, I'm not what you think I am. I know what I am. So I'm just going to say it was awesome time and drop out.
So did you, in your way, like, when you were saying before, I don't fit in anywhere, part of me thinks, having never been to art school, I went to kind of wacky devised theatre school in Dartington. So it was pretty cut open a rabbit and find a poem inside. There was quite a lot of that. So it was sort of almost art school, but without the, but with even less actual skill involved often. But, was it And part of me, like, from a layperson's perspective, like, wow, you even managed to not fit in at art school. Like, presumably, I might imagine the people at art school were people that didn't fit in other places. Or is that totally wrong?
No, but that's true. I didn't fit in, and that's because I was more businesslike. I was actually not appropriate. I wasn't quirky enough for art school. I look like I should have fit in art school, but actually I was too business-minded and too driven in certain areas and thought, okay, what's going to save us? What's going to save me time? What should I be doing? And I've always thought about this in terms of my career because I do so many different things. Like, I've got to pick the winning horse whilst it's winning. Like, I don't know, this doesn't make sense at all. I've tried to describe it in so many different analogies over the years. But, you know, if I've got five different horses and they're all, you know, trotting along, you know, no, it's not horses, it's dogs. It's dogs. You know, the racing dogs.
Yeah, greyhound racing kind of thing.
Yeah, there we go. So I'm going to go with whatever one is fastest on the day. So right now it's writing. So I'm going with that for a bit.
Yeah.
But I might go back to drawing, or I might go back to doing shows. But right now I'm putting my money behind that one.
Gotcha. It's like you're the agent of all of the different yous with the different careers. And if one of them has a particular success, you're like, let's focus attention on that one.
Exactly. Because also I know that my heart is in doing drawings. That is what I feel like I was meant to be, is just an illustrator. So it's like I'm saving that for when I, you know, for a rainy day. Right now I'm going to try and push myself in other arenas. But the doodle shop is lovely because it's something that just kind of ticks along and is what is a very calming thing for me to do.
I think the word, it is an awful word I learned recently, which is solopreneur. Are you familiar with that word?
No.
It's entrepreneurs who are like the whole thing themselves. And I think I'm probably one and you're probably one as well. We don't need to like the word. And mostly people just use it to try and sell you pyramid selling, you know, stuff
okay.
about,
no,
you
I
know.
Like the word.
Yeah, yeah. So, so you're a solopreneur.
That's what I'm going to put on my bio and all of my Instagram.
You wouldn't be alone in doing that. But you might be particularly qualified to do that. Like, we don't really think about it in terms of art because, like, no one ever, it's one of my kind of bugbears really, is no one ever talks in terms of creative efficiency. I love having loads of things on. I probably, if I don't love, I probably on some level get off on. I'm excited by the panic that comes with, oh God, which one of my projects can I pay attention to most today? Because there's so much on and I'm sort of, sometimes I feel like I'm drowning in them, but that's quite exciting, you know, keeps me busy. That I have that kind of work ethic to an extent. I think for me, the dream would be to have something like the Doodle Shop, whereby something that you find relaxing and positive of itself can be monetized for passive income.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Exactly. I know. And it was so surprising as well. And also Alfie's idea, because I've always done drawings. That's how I started off, like doing a drawing day on Twitter. And he was the one to say, you should do prints. You should start a shop. And I always just thought, no, people aren't going to buy them. What? And he was the one to do that. He's always been so encouraging like that. And even my agent, quite often when I said, oh, I'm busy because occasionally I do hand drawings for people and I personalize them and it takes up a lot of time. And especially during lockdown, actually, that was my main job. And she was like, you should be charging more. And I'm like, but people won't buy them if they're more than £8. And so I am very businesslike and driven, but I also am just innately desperate. And constantly I'm surprised that people like anything I do or buy them or subscribe to them or come to a show. So I think that's what is the main driving force in my career, is just like the fear that no one's going to turn up or no one's going to buy it or no one's going to like me. So while they do, just make the most of it.
Yes. Tell us quickly about the book.
Well, the book is called Sunset, which is not very original, given that my other show was Sunrise, and people do think it must be something related to Sunrise, but it's absolutely not. It's about two sisters. And I got the book deal just after Ben died. And it was just a massive decision, really, to either do it or not. And I thought, okay, actually, given, you know, what I said about my life kind of being suddenly, you know, it was a massive crossroads. And so I thought, actually, I'm going to do something completely different. And so I did spend 2 years writing it. And it's a novel. And it's about two sisters, and it's kind of very much rooted in me and Bibi's relationship, but it's based on, it's about a, one of them dying, and that's something obviously I could write about, and dying, you know, by a sudden trauma accident. She basically jumps off a cliff and doesn't come up, which weirdly was in the news today. A girl jumped off a cliff and didn't come up. Mm. Anyway, so it was traumatizing to write and brilliant. And it is funny, hopefully, which is also, I think when they were trying to first market the book, it was quite interesting because, again, they were going for Harry Potter actress writes romantic comedy. And I think that's what they wanted. But halfway through, I was like, okay, this isn't that at all. This is not a comedy, and but it is funny, but it's dark, and it's just been my whole last 2 years, and it's finally out, and it's really exciting because I kind of feel like it's the beginning, but also the end. And like I was saying about, it's kind of charted my first 2 years of grief, which I now couldn't write about. Like, I wouldn't know what it's like in the immediate aftermath of a trauma now, because I don't remember, because I blocked it all out. So I'm really glad I've written about it, because it's very particular to this stage of grief, which is the sudden, quick, brutal aftermath. Mm. So, and it's not like I was trying to write the book to help people, but I did find in the, I needed to read stuff after Ben died. Like, I needed to read stuff, and all the books that were out there about death were memoirs or like the kind of books that are like the five stages of grief, and that really books that just, if you type in books about grief, you know, you get the top five. And I read the top five, and then I was like, but these haven't helped me because they weren't really particular to sibling loss. And so this is a particular book about sibling loss, but it's also hopefully a universal book about the sibling bond and how you can be nasty to each other but still love each other. And if it makes anybody kind of, if it helps anyone through grief, or if it helps anyone just text their sister or brother after they read it to say, oh, we haven't spoken in a few weeks, but I just want to say I love you, or whatever, that would be like what I want from it. So yeah.
did you find in writing it, because it seems like you said it's kind of based in your relationship with Bibi, the work of yours that I've seen on stage, it's completely, there's no subtext. I don't mean there's no subtext, the criticism. What I mean is it's actually about the people you're naming and the real names. And a question I sort of had vaguely racked up was the names on the embroidery. Would it make a difference to you if you'd changed the names? Would it ever occur to you to safeguard people's privacy by changing the names? And if so, would that create a flaw in the art, or would it not matter at all because the emotion was the same?
Yeah, it didn't even occur to me to change the names. And I don't think it would have made such an impact, actually. Maybe I should have.
Like, you'd also be the only person that knew, but that would be an issue for you, because it wouldn't function as a diary anymore. It wouldn't function as a document, maybe.
Yeah. I think I'm always so primed to be attacked in a creative way, like, you know, to be for people to criticize me. So I thought, well, it has to be honest, because then at least I can respond honestly. So if I change the names, then it suddenly becomes fiction and it suddenly becomes not true. Whereas if this is my account of what happened, or it, at least I can fight back. So that's the blurry thing about the book, because it isn't me and Bibi, but it is rooted in both of us. Like, we're a mixture of both of the sisters. As is my mum. My mum's a bit of both of them too, and Ben is massively a bit of both of them. And so that's been a luxury, to suddenly realise I can do fiction, and it doesn't have to be chained truth, and we can have other aspects of our personality that are actually great or horrible, and it's not us. That's been incredibly liberating, and something I definitely will, I think, go forward with.
Just because
of how freeing I found it.
Just, sorry, I slightly missed that. What was it that was particularly liberating? What was the realisation there?
The realisation that I can write, and it doesn't have to be me, and it doesn't have to be Bibi or Alfie, or it doesn't have to be completely my story. It can be an imagined story, and it can be other people's things, but there can be parts of that that are a little bit true or inspired from truth, but I can go more with it or less with it. And
yes, I understand. I understand. Because you've got this enormous wealth of experience at writing down what is true, now you can sort of loosen off the truth. I don't know what that was.
I can kind of just, you know, springboard from that truth and go into different territories and not, I don't know, I've never felt qualified to write fiction.
Yeah.
And now I feel a little bit more just because I've written so much of the nonfiction. I don't know. I think it's really been good practice.
Talk to me about the idea of qualifications. I'm interested in that word qualified, about how we regard ourselves, sort of our entitlement to, that's a negative, I don't mean any of the negative connotations, but what entitles us to write, what qualifies us to write or to create art?
Well, no, I am so, so not about qualifications now. And I now that I've written it, and I have always felt that I'm not qualified to be a writer and I shouldn't call myself one, and I don't have a degree, I don't really spell very well, I definitely don't know anything about grammar. But it's only with encouragement from other people who've read my writing and them saying, that doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. All that matters is the story and the characters and how you're writing it. It doesn't matter about the grammar or anything like that. So I think that it's a massive thing that, you know, people want to have. They want to have a reason to be there. So they're like, well, I've got this qualification and this and this and this, so I should be allowed to be called a writer. But it doesn't. It's really not about that anymore. I think it's about the ideas and if you're going to be the one to actually make the effort to write it down. And I think that's so often people say that they write and they really just don't. And it's just about putting yourself out there, really, is the qualification.
That's really interesting. Someone once said to me about my perceived threat of someone using an idea that I'd come up with for something. And someone's like a mentor figure in my life said, you're only an idea is only as good as the ability to execute it. And I think that's sort of similar territory, isn't it? Like, it's what is writing? It's turning up. If you were the one that could be bothered to write down the thoughts, you were a writer.
Exactly. And also everything that I've ever written is just because I had the wherewithal to get my pen and to write it down there and then, so I remembered exactly what was said. And it stood me in good stead. And I think that, actually just doing it is, it doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't, the ideas that you have, it's just about actually executing them and doing it. And so many people think, oh, I've got this idea for a short film, but it has to be like filmed properly and has to, you know, have a director and has, it doesn't. I think everyone overthinks everything. It just has to be about just writing it down and making it.
When it came to the recording of Sunrise, which happened during Corona and to an audience of one, BB, which was great because I saw it live and I then watched I Loved Her on the Soho On Demand service. And then I thought, oh, I'll just brush up. I'll just revise this morning on a bit of Sunrise. And then I started it and I went, oh, wow, this was recorded recently. And there's no, like, tell me about that. Tell me how different. I was so glad I went back to it because I saw it in like a huge room in Edinburgh, you know, in the Assembly, a big full room. Talk to me about the experience of doing it just to BB.
Well, I was in my, I felt very safe and I feel quite ashamed to say that really because I loved doing It's Just BB. And when they said, I'm really sorry, but I won't be able to have an audience because of the virus and everything, I was thrilled. And that did make me feel very guilty because obviously Alfie's a stand-up and he's had his job basically taken away from him. And he relishes an audience and lives for that, you know, the buzz of having an audience there. And so I did feel slightly like, oh, right, his argument about it not being stand-up is kind of, this has proven his point, really. So I felt very safe. And also, I do act and I have done quite a lot of it. And it was very much like filming something, but, you know, just doing a number of takes. And I enjoy that part of it. I enjoy drilling something and doing it. And that was always something I found really disheartening about doing it live so many times because I would be like, but I can do that better.
I can
do that so much better.
Fascinating. It never even occurred to me. Of course, you can stop. It's only BB. Mm. You can stop and retake a bit. Did you go all through the way? Did you go all through it in one go or was there
Well, no, it was great because the baby was so little, we were allowed to, I just said, I can only do it if we're going to do it in like really like particular hours in the day. So we just filmed it over about 3 days, rehearsed it too. So I could just do a few hours at a time. So it wasn't rushed. It wasn't like a show you record in the evening and you do 2 tries and that's it. It was like, I had probably about 3 takes of every bit. So it was perfect. I'm not saying that I like the outcome. I'm really glad that it was filmed professionally, and Adam Brace is amazing, and Andrew Nolan, who is the DOP, is amazing too. But I do think I could have done it a lot better still. But the great thing is, with age and kind of my pride is not as, I'm not as proud as I think I once was. It doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter. Like, it's good enough. And it gives the show is, that's a fine example of what it is. It's not the best version of it, but yeah, it's good enough.
That is such a great thing to hear an artist say. I was talking to my friend Amanda this morning about sort of about those things, about the, so there's a concept in the therapy that I've explored years ago about daring to be average. Dare to be average. And it sounds just like you want to run a mile from it because it's like, oh God, I don't want to be average. And just in talking to her about it, I was understanding, it's dare to be average for oneself. Not dare to be an average person, but recognize and embrace the fact that 50% of your work won't be as good as the other 50% of your work, because you cannot maintain the top 10 percentile of your creative or performative ability. You can't do that the whole time, because that would be impossible. It would no longer be the top 10%. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So actually, forgiveness, I suppose what I'm talking about is forgiveness as an artist, or compassion, self-compassion as an artist.
Yeah, totally. I'm much less of a perfectionist now. I don't think I've actually ever been a perfectionist. And given that I think that Alfie is, and I think BB is, to a certain extent, I've always been like, let's just do it and put it out there, doesn't matter. There's definitely, you know, I'm not striving to be average, but I don't want to be precious about things. And that's just the way it was. I didn't get another take. Okay, well, that's good enough then. That's fine.
I love it. I'm really excited about the idea of being a drill sergeant, but not a perfectionist. That seems to me to be key to a happy creative life.
Yeah, I do find whenever I'm very prepared for something, then I'm not as bothered when it's not perfect. We had one experience, me and Alfie, of actually in the breakup period, just before we broke up, I think it probably was the trigger. He was doing a show, and basically I said to him, I went to see the first show in Edinburgh, and I was like, this, you have to do this with it. You have to drill this. You have to put this bit here in it. And so I made him get up in the mornings and I made him drill it. And he hated me for it. Like, he really, really did not enjoy that process. But when a month later, it was absolutely amazing. We did break up because of that period of time, but because I was awful. But at the same time, it did make me, I am very much like that. I just think if you're prepared and you know what you're trying to say, then you can be a bit more free and enjoy it more.
What's your biggest failure artistically?
My biggest failure artistically is absolutely wasting 8 years in development for TV. So I spent 2000, I've been in development about 5 or 6 times with different production companies. I was in development with Channel 4 for 8 years with one idea, and it got rejected 8 years later. I wasted so much time working on that, thinking it would happen, with a number of executives, different commissioners. And the production company was great, but I should have had the guts to say no early on, rather than thinking, oh, I need to get this made. It's Channel 4, you know. I should have had the guts to be like, this isn't going to happen. I'm not going to waste my time, because I could have put my efforts into other things. I should have kept making YouTube videos. I wish I'd done that. I wish I'd kept that up. I got sucked in to the power and thinking, oh, but this is legit. This is a channel. And it really is not all it's cracked up to be. And those 8 years are invisible. No one can see all the work I did. The script's there. Yeah, the script gets shopped around, but it's not going to get made. And I'm never doing that again. And, you know, you can waste so many hours having these meetings for development things, and it all comes to nothing. I mean, I'm sorry to be a pessimist about it. Some obviously there are shows getting made, but sure. I've spent almost a decade in development, and there's just no point for me anymore. I'm not ever going to get hurt like that again.
Thank you. That's a really good answer. I'm an efficiency nerd as well, and it just doesn't seem like a sensible trade-off. It doesn't seem like a gamble I'm willing to take to put years into making a thing that then is decided by someone else's whim. And now everything I do is just me.
Exactly. And also, who is the judge of this thing? It's usually a development. It's very rarely somebody who's more qualified than you who's saying yes or no. Or I know we just talked about, you know, what qualification means, but they're having a number of things in development with many other people, but you just get tricked into thinking that this is going to be worth it. They actually really like this one, or this is, and I'm not talking about like early stages development. This is years of working on one script, working on a treatment, working on an episode outline, just like stuff that should take no time at all, took years. And I just regret it. I shudder to think about how much time I wasted, but you know, it does make me more brutal with things when BB's saying, oh, should I submit this idea for this? Or should I do? I'm like, nope, don't do it. Just make it yourself. Don't do it.
That's good. That's a good preparation for the age of YouTube and zero gatekeepers in which we now live. I suppose that's good. That's a good mentality. You're kind of, for her at least, she's maybe ahead of the curve on, like, you know, one of the most important things management can do for anyone, if we just briefly regard you as BB's management, is to say no.
Yeah. I don't think she'll listen to me, though, which is interesting. I think that everyone has to make their own mistakes, and everyone gets lured in by professionals telling them that they're brilliant, and this time it will be different. This time it will be quick. This will get through the door quick.
That's such a shame, though, if you've arrived at a position of I'm never doing that again.
I really have. Yeah. I mean, obviously, if somebody gave me an offer, I would not say no, but...
Sure.
I don't have any expectation anymore for that kind of thing. And as a result, I don't really respect much that gets made anymore. I very rarely enjoy something and think that was amazing, that was brilliant. Quite often I'm like, that got through the door, well done them. But it, you know, how many years did that take?
Off the back of that, how do you, you may have answered this already, but how do you cope with failure?
I expect failure. So I don't expect anything to do well or anyone to like anything. I'm very, very, very negative. To a massive fault, I expect it to go badly.
How do you, if you were advising someone else on how to cope with failure, with perhaps a little more optimism rather than the kind of negativity. Like, how do you wish you did cope with failure? What do you think would be good for you to do to cope with failure? Rather than to have a kind of negative, anticipatory, get the attack on myself in first kind of attitude.
I don't know. I think it's quite good to not really have any expectations, because then when things do go well, and if you do put the work in, then it's a bonus. I think I've been hurt so much by career things not working out, that like the development stuff, that I think any hope has been stamped out of me. But I guess it goes back to being prepared. If you work hard and you're prepared, then the failure won't hurt as much, because then you know you've done your best. And I think that's exactly what I'm kind of preparing myself for with the book. Like, if it doesn't do well, I've tried my best, like I've done everything possible, so that's okay.
And do you have an internal metric for what will be sufficient in terms of it doing well, in inverted commas? Like, how well does it need to do for you to feel like it's done well?
I think that the best way to cope with failure is just to try it again in a different way. I just think that I've never been put off by failure. I never stopped trying after it. Yeah. But that might be because of my tennis upbringing, you know, like you lose matches all the time.
That's a really good point. I don't hear enough on this podcast about analogies of sport or games, because if you're a footballer or a tennis player or whatever, you expect to frequently lose and you have to get used to it. Whereas as a comic, as a performer, if you attempt to be funny and it doesn't work, it's very hard to think to yourself, oh, that's a no-score draw or the equivalent. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. It hasn't ever crushed me. Whereas my sister and I think my other siblings, it did. It does crush them a lot more. Whereas I'm just very pragmatic about it. And I have very low expectations anyway. So that's quite lucky. But yes, it isn't. I'm not the happiest person to be around, probably.
Well, you've preempted my very last question, which is, are you happy?
I am happy. And that's something like I don't take for granted. And also I never thought I would say after the last 2 years. But that's the thing that people don't really understand about grief and tragedy. I think you can still be happy. You just also have this darkness. Rob Delaney said it so brilliantly after his three-year-old died. He said, it's like I can still see the rainbow, but now I have an extra black layer in it. Mm. And I completely relate to that. Like I'm able to still be happy. I would call myself happy right now. I'm very content. But I have this huge sadness in me daily as well. So yeah, it's a conflict, but it's definitely manageable, and happiness wins usually.
Thanks, Jessie.
Oh, thank you.
So that was Jessie Cave, a really, really enjoyable interview, and just someone who I'm really inspired by her creative approach to everything. And I would love to be a bit less of a perfectionist and a bit more of a drill sergeant. I feel like I get a lot done, but it's never enough. I spoke to one of you. I spoke to a very kind member of the ComCom Pod fraternity called Jeremy, who is a project manager. And Jeremy and I are sort of he's giving me really useful advice about projects and time management. And I'm sort of pathetically trying to offer him things in return. But I just the knowledge, like the very first thing he said to me was, you realize this list of everything that you have to do is too much for one person to do. And to just hear someone say that was extraordinarily powerful. Having said that, Jessie just seems to find the time. Maybe she is the kind of sunrise power woman that she talks about in the show Sunrise, after all. And you really have got to watch those shows. They're on the Soho On Demand service and you rent them for 48 hours for £4 or £5. Both of those shows are absolutely fantastic, so please get stuck into those. You can follow her on all the socials at Jessie Cave or go to jessiedoodles.com to find her website. You can find out all about her novel Sunset there as well. And the Patreon for her podcast, We Can't Talk About This Right Now, with her little sister Bibi, is at patreon.com/cavesisters, and you can find it on YouTube and what have you. That's the kind of shout-out you have to do for all the things when someone is as busy as Jessie. So thank you to her for being on the show. Thanks for listening. The logging was Jake Crossland. The editor is Nathan Wood. The music is by Rob Smout, and your podcast consultant is Pete Dobbing. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and you can contact me info@comedianscomedian.com. You can check out the comedianscomedian.com website and go to the Insiders Club if you wish to join that or support the show. You get all of your episodes ad-free, plus you get all of the extra content from every show that has it, which is just a huge amount of stuff now, so jump on that if you fancy. And also the recent Insiders Q&As with people like Nish Kumar, James Acaster, Fern Brady, as well as Alfie Brown, the aforementioned Alfie Brown, and the incredible Self-Help for Comedians special with psychologist Amanda Donnett. All of that at the Insiders Club. No post-amble today, loads on. I've been getting back to work and it's been really exciting. But the thing that is occupying all my time at the moment is my 30 Days of Resilience video challenge on LinkedIn. So if you can find me on LinkedIn, Stuart Goldsmith Comedy Insights, have a little look at that. I've got about, I can't possibly have 10 days left of it. It's been going on for so long. But I think there are something like 9 or 10 days left. There's some video clips there with people like Russell Howard, Catherine Bohart, Rosie Jones, me just kind of filtering out some little tips on resilience from various interviews that I've done. So have a look at those.
And follow me on the socials at ComComPod. That's everything. We've got some belters in the can coming up. Josh Johnson, very, very exciting. He's coming out next week. Then we have Paul Zerdin. And also, I'm interviewing someone else very entertaining later this week. More news once it's safely in the can. Bye for now.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.